Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic Bee Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website at www.theorganicbee.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post a question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, send us a tweet on Twitter to @TheOrganicView, or you can contact me directly at June Stoyer. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com. Sometimes in order to truly experience all that a particular village, town, or city has to offer, you just have to be there. When it comes to traveling, there is so much to be experienced. Whether it is the local fair, the people, the music, or simply some sort of trivial amusement, there is always something that will forever brand the love, or lack of love, in your memory. After all, memories do make the best souvenirs. If you love to travel or are intrigued by stories about lands far away, you will truly appreciate Matt Gross's book, The Turk Who Loved Apples and Other Tales of Losing My Way Around the World. When I think of traveling abroad in strange, unfamiliar lands, I often think about a verse from a poem in one of my favorite novels, Lord of the Rings. Quote, "Not all those who wander are lost." Such is clearly the case when it comes to Matt Gross. If you love to travel and can appreciate good stories from abroad in lands where you may or may not have visited, this is one book you will certainly enjoy. So I would like to welcome to the show Matt Gross. Good afternoon, Matt, and welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Matt, can you please tell our audience about yourself and why did you decide to become a travel writer?
Decide to become a travel writer. I'm not sure it happened quite so intentionally. I guess the main thing to know is that for the last 10 years or so, I've been a travel writer, primarily for the New York Times. I wrote the Frugal Traveler column there from 2006 to 2010, and afterwards did a series called Getting Lost, where I traveled the world with no hotel reservations or contacts or guidebooks or maps. Yeah, so I have been I've been busy. I've been on planes a lot in the last several years, and it's a profession that that I wound up in somewhat by accident.
Speaking of your experience writing The Frugal Traveler, can you share with our audience some of the things that you learned about writing that column that really helped you to appreciate the things that you experience abroad and also some of the things that you try to avoid?
Oh, well, so The Frugal Traveler, the column was all about trying to obviously travel frugally, but not just travel cheaply. I was trying to travel well. The idea was to do, you know, nice middle-class 3 or 4 star adventures around the world, but on a, you know, 1 or 2 star budget. And what I discovered pretty quickly is that when you travel with little money, you have no choice but to come in much closer contact with the people and the cultures that you're visiting. Money has a way of sort of insulating us from both bad things, I mean, discomfort, sickness, loneliness, boredom, but it also has a way of keeping us away from the people and the foods and the experiences that can often be more meaningful. So once I started traveling with next to nothing, I was in it. I was close up to everyone I met and everywhere I went.
Thank you. Now, food is a very big part of the whole experience. What does it mean to, quote, know how to eat?
Ooh, that's a tricky thing. When I was 22 years old and straight out of college, I moved to Vietnam, partly because I really liked the food. I'd eaten it at restaurants in the U.S., and I thought, hey, if I'm going to live abroad in Asia, I should be to live somewhere where I really like the food. But what I quickly learned was that liking the food and knowing how to eat were two very different things. I always seemed to be in good restaurants that happened to be empty or eating foods that my Vietnamese friends considered strange, a noodle soup that everybody else ate for breakfast, I would be eating for lunch. It took me a while to figure out, the how question. What do you eat at what time of day? How are meals constructed? And then also how do you use meals to connect with other people? I think pretty early on I discovered that being willing to eat strange foods, or at least just unfamiliar foods, was a way of spending time with people in foreign countries that they really appreciated. There's nothing that says I'm willing to try to understand you more than saying I'm willing to taste this food that you're offering me.
Thank you. Now, speaking of unfamiliar foods, to you, every meal, every dish, every appetizer, even a piece of fruit is an experience. Were there some food experiences, looking back, that you wouldn't necessarily do again?
There's a few. I mean, I've eaten a lot of strange things, and some of them I like quite a lot. My wife is from Taiwan, and when we go there, we eat things like stinky tofu, which sort of smells like a sewer. We eat these sort of pig's blood and rice popsicles, sort of these little rice and blood cakes on a stick. I think they're delicious. But there's a lot of things that I probably wouldn't eat again if I had the choice. One of those was I had my first week in Vietnam. There's a dish in Vietnam that is sort of called half-hatched egg. It's a duck egg that's been allowed to develop its embryo for a couple of weeks before usually being boiled and then cracked open. So you're eating this fetal egg out of a shell. But I was invited to the home of a professor at the university where I was supposed to be teaching, who, instead of boiling this fetal duck egg, scrambled it. And so this was part of the meal. And I saw on the plate this poor little duck embryo sort of splayed out in a little puddle of yellow and white yolk. And it was just sort of not exactly what I'd been expecting when I moved to Vietnam for the food. And, I ate it as best I could. I remember the little tiny black feathers that were growing out of its skin. And I nibbled at the cartilage and ate some of the egg. And, I can't really say I liked it. I didn't hate it. It wasn't awful. It was maybe a little disconcerting. But I think my willingness to try it, my ability to control that instantaneous recoil from something so unfamiliar and strange and probably to most people pretty disgusting. The fact that I didn't just lurch in horror at the sight of it, I think went a long way. My host became quite a good friend, and it helped me deal with things that were less extreme after that.
Yeah, it's very difficult when you're in a situation in which you're a guest at someone's home and mm-hmm. they're preparing something for you that, with the consideration that this would be something that would impress you or that you would enjoy, and for most people, that experience would have been mortifying. And, it's very difficult when you think about it and you talk about it, when you actually experience it, that is what's tricky. Because you don't want to offend someone. And especially in some countries, food is such a key component to how they live. It's a part of their celebration of life. Food takes on so many different meanings. It's not just something that is used for fuel for the most part.
Excellent. Yeah, I can't think of a single country where that's not the case. That's pretty much how it goes everywhere. One of the things that I figured out I think when I was in college, I came to this epiphany where I realized that if I wanted to eat all foods, I had to realize that foods were what they were, and I could not wish them to be something else. I had to try and appreciate these strange things for what they were. And making that mental adjustment helped enormously. It didn't always work. I mean, there were still things that I encountered that were difficult to stomach mentally as well as physically, but knowing that this was the food, that my wishes and desires weren't going to change what these different dishes were, helped enormously. But that kind of mental adjustment is that's tricky.
Thank you. One of the things that I've found from my travels is when I come back home, I can't necessarily eat the ethnic cuisine here and enjoy it the same way as I have abroad. For example, I spent quite a bit of time in China, and when you come back to the States and you eat Chinese food, it's just completely different. Do you find that your travels have kind of spoiled you in the sense that when you're back home and you are, it doesn't matter where the restaurant is or how great the restaurant is, it's just not as good as what you first experienced in that particular country?
Oh, yeah, it's totally ruined me. I mean, look, I'm in New York, and we have some great restaurants here, but we have terrible Vietnamese food. I mean, it's just, it's depressing. I mean, go to California, and like the worst Vietnamese restaurant in California is better than most than the best Vietnamese restaurant in New York. But, you know, the other thing is I've always loved to cook as well. And especially in the last several years, I did a lot of stories for magazines like Saveur. And now I'm working at bonappetit.com, where cooking and learning how people cook things abroad is what they're all about. So I've studied how people cook in Sichuan province in China, and I can now go home and make these things myself and not worry about the fact that it's hard to access them at restaurants. And for me, it's part of the, you know, it's a fun part of the learning process. I've done these great stories where I go into people's homes overseas and watch them cook. And there's nothing more exciting, there's nothing more intimate, really, than being invited into someone's kitchen and watching them prepare the food that you're all about to share. I've done this in China. I've done this in Taiwan. I've done this in Italy. Oh, man, up in the hills of Abruzzo in Italy, watching people cook meals that we're all about to share. It's wonderful. And so I don't worry so much at this point about not being able to eat not being able to eat as well when I get back home.
There's so much love that goes into the food and into the preparation of the food, especially when it's being prepared, especially by someone who is welcoming a guest into their home with the intention of just sharing part of their culture with you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, they have so many stories to tell about how things came to be, why something is being served a particular way. I got to add also that eating in people's homes abroad is not something that I've been able to do just because I'm, you know, a New York Times travel writer or whatever. In Italy, there's a great organization called Home Food. Their website is homefood.it, and they're all about bringing visitors into the homes of regular Italian families in big cities and little villages, and showcasing not just these sort of regional specialties, but the excellent way that a lot of these families preserve their own recipes and do things in special ways. So I've been in, you know, little towns where, you know, the family hunts wild boar together and then cures the meat in the basement and has their own chickpea farms. It's really incredible. And, you know, anyone can do it, but you have to seek it out, and you have to be prepared.
Yeah, the knowledge that you get from firsthand experience is priceless.
Yeah, that's why we travel, isn't it? Otherwise, we could just stay home and read books. I mean, you know, I'm happy if people want to stay home and read my book, but I hope it inspires them to go out and travel on their own as well.
Now, have you found that because you're so well traveled, you can actually look at the cuisine in a local town or village, what have you, and you can actually make comparisons between how one particular part of the country, for example, makes cheese or makes pasta or mm-hmm. the way that they prepare rice, and notice the subtle differences in the preparation of that food, which will indicate the actual location of the location of the village where it's prepared. Because I found that to be true with cheese. It was interesting.
Oh, yeah, definitely. One of my favorite correspondences was, let's see, in the summer of 2006, I was in northwest Spain, in Galicia, and I had the greatest boiled octopus of my life, you know, just simply boiled and served with olive oil and crunchy salt and pimentón, the smoky chili powder. And after I ate it, I asked, you know, is this local octopus, right? We're right on the Atlantic. And turned out, no, it was actually from Morocco. So I thought, oh, okay, I guess people in Galicia are catching octopus locally and selling it on the world market and importing Moroccan octopus for whatever reason. Maybe it's cheaper, maybe they like it better. And then about a year and a half later, I found myself in Osaka in Japan on the prowl for a snack called takoyaki, which are little nuggets of octopus that are coated in batter and sort of cooked in a cast iron pan and dressed with all these wonderful sauces. Found a beautiful little hole in the wall that had been started 35 years ago by the current owner's father, and they just served the absolute best takoyaki I'd ever eaten. And I started talking to the owner and asking him, you know, where he got his octopus. And guess where he got it? Morocco.
Morocco.
So you have these two cultures on absolute opposite ends of the spectrum getting their octopus from the same place. The guy in Japan told me, for cooked octopus, you want to get it from Morocco. For octopus sushi, you can get it from off the coast of Japan. And so how wonderful is that, that two people in totally different places came to the exact same conclusion. So now, of course, I need to go to Morocco and find out, you know, what kind of octopus they eat.
Yeah, it's interesting. People that truly appreciate good food, you know, they know their ingredients, they know the sources, and they completely understand how to get the most out of the flavor of that food with proper preparation.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, it's one of these things that comes with experience. Nobody's born knowing this stuff, and nobody really learns it from, you know, just a book. But, you know, they learn these things by cooking and watching and eating and doing it all over again every single day of their lives.
Mm. One of the things that I truly appreciated about your book was the fact that you point out what you don't like about being sick, which is the inability to enjoy the food.
Yeah.
People write about being sick when they're traveling. It's really awful, especially if you're in a foreign country and you don't speak the language, you don't know your way around. But I thought that it was really great that you pointed out that this was such a huge part of your traveling experience, and because of illness, you were unable to do something that you truly enjoyed.
This was how it went. I mean, I loved eating so much, and I found it was a great way of connecting with people wherever I went. But, you know, sometimes I would get sick. There's intestinal parasites out there, and especially if you're like me and you kind of eat everything you possibly can, you're going to get sick once in a while. And for me, the illness that I always got was Giardia, which among its many unsavory effects was it killed my appetite. And so it meant that I couldn't even fake being excited about the food that I was presented with. And I lost that ability to connect with people. And that was really the most frustrating thing is, one, I couldn't eat, which I love to do. And two, I couldn't use eating as a way to connect with these cultures. But, you know, luckily I've had this illness enough times now that I know how to treat it pretty well. I know the drugs to take, and I can usually be better within about 24 hours. So, again, this is something you learn with experience. You learn to eat and cook by experience, and you learn how to deal with sickness by experience.
Now, you also wrote about an experience in Germany in which you were picking wild berries, and they were so abundant, and they were absolutely delicious, as you wrote, which I can only imagine. I've been to Germany. It's a beautiful country. Only to find out from one of your fans that there's something called the fox tapeworm, and that's the reason why the locals don't pick the berries. That had to have been mortifying to find that out.
Yeah, that's sort of terrifying, actually. The fox tapeworm is a really nasty bug. It doesn't bother with your intestines so much, but eventually it produces worms that, you know, sort of dissolve your liver. The treatments for it are not very sophisticated because people don't get it all that often, and it usually kills them. I don't know if I have this. I kind of doubt it, but it's one of these things that could be lying in wait for 15 years and then strike me down, all because I wanted to eat the berries that were along the sides of these trails that I was hiking on in Germany. You know, it's sort of terrifying to think of it, I try to console myself with the fact that eating and being willing to eat and try new things has still provided me with so many great experiences. So, you know, if in 10 or 15 years the worms are dissolving my liver, I kind of hope it's been worth it. I mean, I hope they don't bother with my liver. I hope I don't have this thing. But, you know, life is short. And I've tried to experience it and enjoy it as much as possible. And I can't imagine not eating fresh berries. Would you want to go through life never eating fresh berries out in the wilderness?
No.
I wouldn't.
Certainly not. I grew up in the country, so to me, you know, picking fresh berries, that was just part of growing up. And I grow my own berries now, but that experience was just really kind of eye-opening for me, because it's when you're traveling and you see blueberries or raspberries or familiar berry, gooseberries, what have you, you don't think about a consequence like the berries being contaminated.
A deadly illness.
Yeah, who would have ever imagined that something like that would be possible? But I bet you at this point, before you pick berries, you ask the locals, you know, is this safe to eat?
Well, you know, the fox tapeworm is one of these big, supposedly berry-transmitted illnesses. But, you know, foxes are quite short. So the thing I learned is that you should always pick berries above waist height, where the animals are less likely to come in contact with them. So if there's locals to ask, I'll ask them. If there's no locals, I'll pick the high berries.
Thank you. Traveling can often get lonely. However, you wrote about engaging in conversations with some of the locals that almost escalated into an argument. And I know I've had the same thing happen myself, just at, you know, making a simple comment to myself about whether it was the food or just something random, and not realizing how sensitive that comment may be to some of the locals. Do you have any advice for travelers that would like to engage in conversation and break the ice with new people, but kind of in a safe way?
Ooh, I mean, I'm not sure there's any perfectly safe way. I think you should just always be careful about what you're saying. Approach all these conversations and arguments with an open mind and an open face. And be ready to explain cultural inconsistencies that may make you make mistakes. The biggest one that I've gotten into was a late night conversation with a couple of guys on the island of St. Martin in the Caribbean, where I don't even know how we got into the conversation, but we started talking about Adam and Eve and the difference, as I put it, between innocence and ignorance. And when I said the word ignorant, the guys I was talking to, just their tone absolutely changed. They could not imagine, you know, Adam and Eve being described as ignorant. And as I later learned, the word ignorant has a sort of a different meaning in the Caribbean. It's not so much uninformed or uneducated, but there's a kind of willful, angry, stupid, deplorable ignorance there. It's a really highly charged word, and you don't want to use that without thinking. And I'd use it without thinking, without knowing that this sort of neutral word in the U.S. had such a skewed meaning in the Caribbean. So now I am highly aware of that. My ignorance has been alleviated, and I am no longer quite so innocent. But, you know, I couldn't have known about that, really, without sort of stumbling into it. And I backed down, and I learned what was wrong, and we came away from it friends, but it was one of the most eye-opening conversations I'd ever had.
Do you think that because of your travels, you've been able to be more of an accepting person when it comes to cultural differences as well as moral and social beliefs?
You know, I think that's sort of a chicken and egg question. I've always been a fairly curious and open-minded person, and try not to be judgmental because, you know, heck, I'm kind of a weird guy, and I'm used to being judged, so I don't want to apply that same paintbrush to other people. But I've learned to I've learned kind of patience, I think, with everything that happens. And again, you know, this is one of these mental adjustments you make. You tell yourself that you're going to be open-minded. You tell yourself that you're just going to accept the world and its people as they are, not as you wish they would be. And, you know, over over 10 years, over 30 years, and dozens of trips and millions of miles, I think I've gotten that to become an instinct rather than a conscious decision. I don't know if it's going to be like that for everybody, but you know, you travel, you do one trip, you see how it goes, you do another, and hopefully, eventually, it will become second nature.
Well, for you, you don't just travel like the typical person that's on business travels. You really take in everything, whether it's someone that you just happen to meet, even for a few brief moments. You notice that person becomes a part of your memory. And you have done such great job writing this book, The Turk Who Loved Apples and Other Tales of Losing My Way Around the World. You did such a wonderful job incorporating so much detail that I think many people would neglect to even write down. And I think, I'm just curious, when you look back, and actually when you were writing this book, were there any significant memories that came back to you that you felt really changed you as a person?
Well, all of them. you know, I mean, maybe we should talk about the titular character, the Turk Who Loved Apples. I wound up on his organic apple farm in western Turkey through an organization called WOOF, W-W-O-O-F. For Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms. It's an organization that places volunteers on farms all over the world for free. You do a few hours of work a day in exchange for room and board. So that's how I wound up on Kamal Gürgün's apple orchard. I was his only volunteer. It was just me and him and his cat Simi. And Kamal spoke no English. He spoke four words of English, really. Yes, no, okay, and wow. And, you know, over the course of several days of trying to help him take care of the apple orchard, we had to figure out a way to communicate. We had to evolve a way of explaining to each other what we needed, what we wanted, how to take care of the apple trees, what we wanted to do next. And, you know, at first it was a pretty daunting situation. I'm stuck with this guy. I don't have anywhere else to go. I'm in the middle of the countryside, and we don't have a way to talk. And yet, you know, we communicated. We found a way to, in pidgin English and pidgin Turkish, and a lot of hand gestures, and a lot of saying to ourselves, I think, I don't know what you're saying, but I'm just going to go along with it. I'm not going to make a big deal out of it. We wound up becoming, you know, friends. We wound up becoming close. We wound up understanding what the other person was going through as human beings. And that was sort of incredible. How close we got in such a short amount of time, despite having nothing in common and no common means of communication. So that's, I think back to that time again and again and again, and how it just sort of opened my eyes up to what was possible. What I, as a, you know, young travel writer with no particular special skills, could accomplish, even in the strangest and most unfamiliar settings.
Thank you, Matt. Matt, it has been wonderful having you on the show today and to just talk a little bit about this book. There's so many different things that I'd like to ask you, but unfortunately we are running out of time. So I'd like to take the opportunity to thank you for being on the show. And also, if you could share with our audience your website, and also if you have any upcoming book signings or any events that you'll be at, where people can interact with you.
Sure. The best place to follow along for The Turk Who Loved Apples is facebook.com/The Turk Who Loved Apples. I do a lot of publicizing of events and appearances there. You can see what I do at my day job at bonappetit.com. That's about it. Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed talking with you.
And I really enjoyed talking to you and reading your book, The Turk Who Loved Apples and Other Tales of Losing My Way Around the World. What a great book, Matt, and I really hope that you write a sequel to this. This is just such a joy to read. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And folks, thank you so much for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic View Radio Show. Have a great afternoon, everyone.